I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Shrimp used to be a delicacy eaten only on special occasions. Today, it's more popular than canned tuna in the United States. Thailand has become the world's largest exporter of shrimp, and its top three markets are the United States, Japan, and the European Union. While some of the industry in Thailand is high-tech, it also relies on thousands of migrant workers from neighboring countries. The Environmental Justice Foundation just released a report about the human rights abuses in the shrimp industry in Thailand, including human trafficking, child labor, and forced detention. The report is called The Hidden Cost. We asked Steve Trent, the executive director of the Environmental Justice Foundation, which is based in London, to join us on Radio Times. Good morning, or should I say good afternoon to you, Steve Trent. Thanks for joining us today on the show.
It's a pleasure. Good morning and good afternoon.
Good afternoon as well. Are we talking about modern-day slavery when we talk about the shrimp industry in Thailand?
We are indeed. Modern-day slavery, and with that, quite extreme human rights abuses have been exposed, where the common and repeated use of violence as a means to control those people who end up as slaves, provide this product for Western consuming markets, and that perhaps is the thing that has shocked me most, the profound nature of the violence engaged in this, where we have repeated testimonies from individuals across the industry who have seen their colleagues and beaten and on numerous occasions even murdered by those who are engaging in this export industry.
And we're talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of migrant workers, many of them coming from Myanmar or Burma. This is work that Thais don't necessarily do?
That's absolutely right. But estimates are not completely clear, but there are approximately 650,000 workers in the Thai seafood industry. And of that number, more than 90% are migrant workers coming from Myanmar or Cambodia or Laos, the poorer neighboring states to Thailand. And they're there for two reasons. One, because they need work. They want employment. They want to get that income to send home to their families and to support themselves. But perhaps more importantly in the discussion we're having, because the Thai workers now no longer will do this work because it is tough and brutal for them. So they have shipped in this migrant workforce, many of whom, I would say most of whom, are working illegally because they're trafficked into the country and hence very vulnerable. And that is what is driving this industry, a cheap migrant workforce, often shipped in illegally and working illegally with no protection, and therefore they are subject to this really quite intense abuse.
And I do want to talk about the kind of work that they do, but your report also includes some descriptions of, I guess, being trafficked or smuggled into Thailand. One of the people that you interviewed talked about walking 9 nights and 8 days through the forest. I'm not sure if it's a man or a woman. I faced hunger and many troubles. I saw the sexual abuse of girls. There were robbers that came down and put guns to their heads and robbed them of their property. And he witnessed girls in the bush being raped one after another. Is this a typical description of what happens or what can potentially happen being smuggled from, let's say, Burma into Thailand?
It's a typical description of what can happen. And then even worse, we have seen some of the workers that have been shipped into the country are then sold onto the fishing boats that go out and find that fish for the so-called trash fish, small, less valuable species that are used to make up the feed that goes into the shrimp ponds, that actually feeds the shrimp. And perhaps where we see the descriptions and hear the repeated descriptions of violence and abuse of the workers being trafficked into the country, it doesn't just stop at that point. It goes on to where they're actually in the process of producing these shrimp. And you see workers sold onto boats, sold into slavery. And there, some of the descriptions of the violence are truly astonishing, where you hear, again, as I say, repeated use of murder, execution-style murders, of individuals and workers, either because they're too tired, too ill to work, or as a means of control of the workers on the boats and in other parts of the industry.
I mean, kind of a terrorism to keep people in line, I guess.
Yes, exactly that.
Your report also focuses in the shrimp industry on what's called these peeling sheds, where workers, I guess, they take the heads, the veins, the shells off the shrimp?
Yes, well, this is another weak spot. There are a number of weak spots. I've just mentioned the boats, but also in what's known as the pre-processing and the processing plants, where you can see, again, the vulnerability of the workers allows and facilitates the abuses. So you can see, if you look at what's going on in the peeling sheds, the Thailand's Department of Fisheries has registered about 200 peeling sheds. That's what it says it has under its control and that exists in the countries. Less than hundreds of those are registered with a body called the Thai Frozen Foods Association, which is a prerequisite for access to the international markets. You have to be registered to that association to be allowed to export. But if you dig deeper, if you pull back the covers on this, even the most conservative estimates that say there are around 400 of these peeling sheds, and those are unregistered, and some of the leading Thai non-government organisations put that figure at around 2,000 unregistered peeling sheds. And it's there again where you've got this hidden workforce, many of whom have been trafficked in, many of whom will have been are therefore working illegally without papers, without documents, that you can see the real worst of the violence and the abuse is taking place. And much of this, we feel, is undertaken almost with connivance of the authorities. We've been able to gather evidence of local authorities and some of the statutory agencies that should be protecting these people, including the police, actually conniving in their abuse simply to get the profit that is available to them from having cheap, or in the case of the slave labor, free workers producing the shrimp product that comes to the United States and Europe and Japan.
Another quote, and this is from one of the workers at one of these peeling sheds, happens to be 11 years old, saying, it is a very hard job. It is very hard, as I have never worked this job before. And since I'm not tall enough, I had to stand on a basket when working. And another quotes from some of these other younger workers. How many of these workers do you think are children?
Very hard to say. Our estimate is that the majority are adults, but we are equally certain that there are children and underage people entering this market and being used in the peeling sheds, the pre-processing plants, and also on the fishing boats. But the majority are adults.
And, I mean, do they make money? Is there any way that these migrants coming into work, the shrimp industry, that they make any money, that has any meaning for them?
Yes, I mean, some of the workers do. And as you would find in most situations like this, you have the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there are some players in the marketplace, some business interests, even if they are using illegal migrant workers who have been trafficked in, will be paying something close to a reasonable wage and will be giving reasonable conditions and trying to look after them. And certainly among the bigger, more legitimate industries now, you can see there's a push to try and clean up because they're worried about their reputation, about brand, in the face of this ongoing release of evidence about the abuses. But at the same time, you have business interests that are very happy, comfortable, so long as they can remain hidden, so long as they're not found out, to pay minimal wages, give workers appalling conditions that would be totally unacceptable in the United States or Europe, and on occasion to use slaves and to use them in a way that is almost totally out of control, where if somebody is not able to work or is rejecting the conditions they're in, they will quite simply be murdered.
Mm.
We look at this situation for ourselves. We conduct detailed field investigations. We've been out there. We've gathered the testimony. We've seen it. But I think it's very important at this stage to say this is not just the findings of one organisation like the Environmental Justice Foundation. If you look at a 2009 survey from the United Nations, they are saying 59% of the people that they surveyed had witnessed a murder of a colleague on a boat. 59%. It's at that kind of scale that the worst end of this industry is operating.
Even though I should add to that, the U.S. State Department recently downgraded Thailand, also Malaysia and Venezuela, because of human trafficking. So the State Department also raising some concerns about the treatment of workers. Steve, you know, I can imagine, and myself as well, someone listening to this and thinking, you know, how do I know if the shrimp that I buy at the supermarket comes from Thailand? Should we assume that most of the shrimp that we buy does come from Thailand?
Well, it's coming from the region. It's very hard to identify whether it's coming from Thailand, and this is one of our key points to business interests at the retail end of the market who are selling to customers in the United States and Europe. We're saying open up, make it transparent. You need to make clear where your product is coming from and what steps you have taken to ensure that it's not been produced by slaves and it's been produced by legitimate businesses who are going to take reasonable care of their workers. It's having a transparency in this supply chain is perhaps the key thing that will drive down the kind of change we need to see to make sure that the products we're consuming have not been produced by slaves. In the past, there's been significant resistance to that, with all sorts of claims about how difficult it is because of the complex supply chain involved, how it might be an unreasonable burden on the companies involved, and how even in some instances where companies and organizations have simply said, this is nothing to do with us, it's not our business is selling products, it's not about monitoring what goes on in the production of that product. We feel very clearly that any responsible business operating on the high street of Manhattan in the States or Manchester in the UK or wherever you want to look should now be closely examining its supply chain, identifying the weak spots, inspecting them closely, and making sure that their product has been produced in an ethical and sustainable manner.
Steve, hold on. Yeah, Steve, I'm sorry. Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Steve Trent, Executive Director of the Environmental Justice Foundation, about the report, The Hidden Costs, Human Rights Abuses in Thailand's Shrimp Industry. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Rider University supports WHYY. Rider invites listeners to learn about how its executive MBA program can help professionals leverage their business experience into greater leadership roles in their organizations. Final interviews for the fall 2014 semester are concluding soon. Info at rider.edu/EMBA or 609-896-5036. Rider University, preparing tomorrow's business leaders.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I'm talking fast to get in shape for this week's program. You see, every week on our program, we bring you 3 to 4 stories on some theme, blah, 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 you know the drill. But this week, we throw that slow-paced, thoughtful nonsense to the wind and bring you 20, yes, 20 stories in 60 minutes. Frankly, we wanted to do 30 stories in 60 minutes, but at this point, we don't know if we can pull that off. I guarantee you at least 20. To see how many we speed through, listen this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and here's a sound you're unlikely to hear in Wichita Falls, Texas, which is in Stage 5 drought. Not a lot of sprinklers because of the worst drought on record there, and conservation efforts have not been enough to stop the shrinking of local reservoirs. So what's the city to do? We'll ask next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Steve Trent. We're talking about shrimp, and we're curious about whether you eat shrimp. If you do, there's a good chance it came from Thailand, has become the world's largest exporter of shrimp. And there are some disturbing stories from Thailand about human trafficking in the shrimp industry. That's what the Environmental Justice Foundation that Steve Trent heads up found in a report just released called The Hidden Cost. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at whyy radio times. Is it time for a boycott of shrimp? How about transparency that Steve Trent was just talking about? Do give us a call or send us an email or send us a tweet as well. Steve, do you think a boycott would be effective? You talked about the importance of transparency, putting pressure on the industry to come clean, I guess, about where its shrimp comes from.
I think boycotts are blunt tools, and they on occasion can leverage some impact, but all too often they're clumsy, if you like. And what we would like to see is a clear commitment from the major retail companies to use their economic muscle, the power that they have through the purchasing power of their customers, to demand and insist that the shrimp that they purchase has been produced in a legitimate, ethical and sustainable way. And I think they can do that by drilling down through their supply chains, making sure they know where their product comes from and how it was produced, and letting their customers know. They can have a profound impact on this market and on the means of production. I think possibly the most direct and simple course to getting rid of these abuses, to stopping slavery, modern-day slavery in our seafood production, is by using the power of our wallets, the dollar in your wallet, to make sure that the product that you buy is a good one and has not been produced by slaves. So rather than a boycott, I think it's an active engagement, but a forceful one, with the authorities in Thailand and with the companies in Thailand, letting them know that nothing less than a clear commitment that this is not going to happen anymore, and the proof of that commitment being put into action, will do. And I think that is the way forward for us. We, as an organization, we're not interested in putting people out of jobs or closing markets and businesses down. What we want to see is well-run, sustainable, ethical businesses that have no place for slavery or violence or this kind of abuse.
I was reading that Carrefour recently suspended purchasing food from CP Foods, which apparently is the largest shrimp supplier in Thailand. So clearly, looks like Carrefour is putting pressure on CP Foods. Do you think that is an effective approach?
I think there's room for that kind of approach, certainly. CP controls something like between 10 to 15% of the market in Thailand for the shrimp. It supplies many of the major Western brands, and certainly they will be feeling the pressure from Carrefour's action. But again, I think what we want to see is those big companies that have the capacity, have the power to change their production methods, to make sure that they're transparent, that they understand what's going on at every stage in the supply chain, to push forward with that work, leverage, open it up, lift the veil, if you like, on this, and then come back to American consumers, to European consumers, and show them, this is a good product. It's a quality product that's being produced ethically, and you can eat it with a clear conscience. That I think is the way forward, but others will be looking at this approach whereby they are in effect saying enough is enough. We're talking about slavery here and murder, and we simply can't accept that in the products we're selling. So I think there is some scope for those kind of actions, but in the longer term, we need constructive, positive engagement, and we need to see the businesses in Thailand, and indeed the government there and all its agencies, responding and acting responsibly. Up until now, most of what we've seen has been a variation on PR campaigns and exercises without any real depth and substance to the statement.
Do you see a role for consumers wondering, even if consumers, you know, ask the fish people at the supermarket, can they tell you honestly where the shrimp comes from?
Absolutely. I think that's profoundly important. In our view, in the world that we live in now, very often you have as much power as a consumer as you do as a voter. And leveraging the power of your dollar, if you go to your retailer, if you go to your supermarket brand, wherever you shop, and say, can you tell me where the product came from? Can you tell me it's free from slavery and this kind of abuse? Can you demonstrate to me how you know? That has a huge impact. I think it's the one thing that the boardrooms listen to. If they feel that people are going to vote with their wallets and vote with their feet, walking out of their shops to go somewhere else for a more ethical product, then they start to get worried and they will act. And I think that's incredibly important. People often feel, I think, disengaged, perhaps disempowered, and feel that problems lie way beyond them in another country, thousands of miles away. There's nothing they can do about it. But the reality is, in the world we live in now, by making your voice heard, simply letting your retailer know that you're concerned about this and letting them know that unless they can show you that they don't have slavery and don't have violent abuse in their supply chain for shrimp or other seafood products, they won't purchase from them anymore, then things will change. So it's an incredibly powerful tool.
I'm curious, though, you mentioned the fact that there are some responsible suppliers. Is there a way of trying to promote them versus the irresponsible ones?
There is indeed, and it's one of the things that we always look for, looking for industry leaders, and whether that may be a well-known high street brand that is coming out and saying we're going to take positive action, or whether it be a business that's hidden behind the scenes, to actively promote them, to encourage them, and to a point, tell consumers where they can go with surety that the product is good. I think at this stage it's also important to say something else.
Sure.
That there are different levels, if you like, in this. For us, we feel where there's slavery and violence, almost a zero-tolerance policy, that we can't accept this in the 21st century. We thought we had left slavery behind many, many years ago, and in fact, it's live, it's real, and it's providing us with cheap products. On a different level, I think there are industries in developing world countries in producing shrimp, and small element of this may be true in Thailand, where they're struggling with the transition, but they are committed to it, and they are driving forwards. If they can demonstrate that commitment, and they're clear, and they're forceful, and they want to engage, then I think we should give time, a bit of time for them. But in this instance, with regard to shrimp coming from Thailand, it's very hard to see yet anyone who is leading that market, where we could be sure that there's 100% free of slaves, 100% free of the kind of abuses we're talking about. And that's the problem we have. We need to see action happen quickly and at a deep-rooted level. The superficial things that have been engaged in the past just won't do any longer.
And let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Steve Trent. He's the executive director of the Environmental Justice Foundation. The agency just released a report called The Hidden Cost, Human Rights Abuses in Thailand's Shrimp Industry. Steve Trent, also the founder of Wild Aid. He spent the last 25 years or so campaigning for wildlife, environmental security, and human rights. And we want to hear from you about how you wrestle with whether to buy shrimp or not, or perhaps you've already decided. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Steve, we had a tweet from Joe. He said, I just bought shrimp from Vietnam. The country was marked on the package. Can we say that it doesn't have the kind of human rights abuses that we've been talking about related to Thailand and shrimp?
I think we can't. There have been problems in the past in the Vietnamese industry, but very different. And I think the one thing that really characterizes the industry in Thailand and takes it to a totally different level model there has been predicated on this migrant workforce coming from other countries, and that's not what happens in Vietnam. So you have this huge labor force that's working in Thailand, and as I said before, many of them without papers or documentation, working illegally, and that makes them vulnerable. And that vulnerability has been exploited by unscrupulous businesses. And to an extent whereby we have seen repeated use of extreme violence and murder and the use of slaves. You have a thriving slave industry in the Thai seafood business, and that's what makes it completely different to almost anywhere else in the world that we've looked at shrimp. With regard to Vietnam,
sure.
Increasing amounts of business are now moving to Vietnam for reasons to do with the health of the shrimp itself and the ability to produce them. And Vietnam does have a different model. I think it is better regulated. There is a closer control of it by the agencies of the government, which means that the kind of things we're talking about here are not really happening there at all.
Would you say, and it's interesting because the State Department also putting some pressure on the Thai government, is there a response from the Thai government that they're going to begin to crack down on this industry and also its reliance on migrant workers, knowing how important the shrimp industry is to the economy of Thailand?
Well, this is another one of the really key points here. In the past, because what has happened is the Thai government has made the right noises, they've made the right statements, but they have then not followed through on them. So they've launched very expensive public relations campaigns. They actually recruited a US-based PR company to work for them. They turn up to the seafood shows, the big international expos where product is bought and sold and deals are done, and they give a very good show, but they haven't delivered on the change. And you can see that because those people who are involved in this abuse, who are using slaves, who have been employing people in abusive conditions and really doing some of the very nasty stuff, none of them have been prosecuted. There haven't been the closures or the interventions by the statutory agencies that you would see if the government was serious. And it's that we need to see changing. They've got to go after the guys that control this, and they need to have arrests and successful prosecutions with real penalties. And it's at that stage that I think you could say the government is starting to act in an appropriate way.
We have an email. Mark wants to know about shrimp sold by what stores like Whole Foods. I don't know if you have Whole Foods in London or in England or not, but these are sort of high-end stores that yes. claim to sell lots of organic vegetables and things like that. Could you say that some of these more high-end stores might have better shrimp? I mean, shrimp that doesn't come from the abuse of labor?
I think some of them do, absolutely. And my understanding of it, I don't have the detail of this in front of me right now. My understanding is that Whole Foods in particular simply said no to Thai shrimp. That was my understanding. I could be wrong, because they were not comfortable and couldn't guarantee that any of the product that they were buying from the country would be sustainable and ethical. So some of the companies are selling a better product. They're selling one that they've looked at closely and that they're monitoring closely. And I think the key thing here that I go back to consumers with again and again is ask them. And if they can't give you a clear answer, both in the store and at a board level, if you like, then the probability is they don't know what's going on, they can't give you a guarantee, and you shouldn't be buying their product.
Let me get Joan to join our conversation. Hi, Joan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Joan?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Joan.
I just wanted to know, whatever happened to the
Oh, we seem to be having some phone problems. Steve, she had a question about farmed shrimp, and we're going to be talking actually in a couple of minutes about shrimp that is and fish coming from the United States. But talk a bit, if you could, I guess, about the kind of process that's used to raise shrimp in places like Thailand.
Well, shrimp traditionally has been almost like a get-rich-quick product, because you you've got relatively low barriers to entry, i.e. you need to put in relatively modest amounts of money to produce the product, and then you can sell it on the international marketplace if you've got enough of it. And it's high value, and it's in demand, as we know, both in the United States and in Western Europe and Japan. In countries like Thailand, they have built a vast industry off the back of that demand, and you have large industrial-scale shrimp farms, you know, large tanks that hold the product. They're produced there. They're fed with fish taken from the sea, often coming from the Gulf of Thailand, the Andaman Sea, this so-called trash fish. They're then treated in the processing plants that we spoke about earlier, where they're peeled, they're beheaded, they're cleaned up, tidied up, frozen, and then sent to the main consuming markets. Mm. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. If you look at Thailand alone, which overall is the world's third largest exporter of seafood, their exports are valued at around over $7 billion in 2011. They're making big money off the back of this product. And I think it's clear that where you've got that kind of money, there's no excuse for not producing it in an ethical and sustainable manner.
And we're almost out of time here. I began by saying, you know, shrimp back in the day was considered a delicacy, and now it's more popular than canned tuna in the United States. Is the sort of popularity of this food part of the problem?
Well, I think it is part of the problem. And I put a different perspective on that. What the retailers tell us, what the major brands tell us, is that their customers now demand this product, they demand that it's cheap, and it comes to them easily. But there is a real price, and hence the title of the report, The Hidden Cost, and that price is being paid by people from poor developing world countries who are being sold into slavery or are being forced to work in conditions that would never be accepted by anyone in the United States or Europe. And that's the big problem. It may be, and I say this completely openly, it may be that the product may cost a little bit more on our supermarket shelves to have that sustainability, to make sure that it's not being produced by slaves. But I challenge anyone to say that, you know, for the matter of a few cents, and that's all we're talking about, they would rather have something that's being produced by a slave.
Well, on that note, Steve Trent, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. He's the executive director of the Environmental Justice Foundation, headquartered in London, England. We've been talking about their new report called The Hidden Cost, Human Rights Abuses in Thailand's Shrimp Industry. We'll be talking with Michael Rubino after this very short break, talking about fish and shrimp here in the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Do surgeons lie?
You'll be out a week, that's it.
The Pulse answers questions about healthcare.
Surgeons really do underestimate what's going to happen to patients.
We cover the latest treatments and why they matter.
They don't need chemotherapy.
On The Pulse, scientists make confessions.
Love shellfish.
We take you to strange places.
We ripen about 35,000 boxes a week.
And your experiences are front and center.
Keep your eyes closed.
The Pulse, Friday morning at 9 on WHYY.
Never, ever open them.
In order to reproduce each year, blueberries, apples, almonds, and other plants rely on pollination by bees. But the nation's honeybee population has declined to the point where the same hives are now packed up and trucked from one crop to the next every year to keep crops pollinated. On the next Fresh Air, biologist Lawrence Packer tells amazing stories about bees. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
In 1957, the reach of segregation extended all the way to the world of literature.
Censorship for us begins with The Color Line.
The Fight to Publish by Langston Hughes and how it paved the way for future black writers. Poet Nikki Giovanni is with us. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We were just talking about human trafficking in Thailand's shrimp industry. America has an enormous appetite for shrimp and other seafood, but we still import the majority of it. Could a strong domestic aquaculture industry be environmentally sustainable and meet the growing demand? Joining us now is Michael Rubino. He's director of the Office of Aquaculture at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Service. A bit of a mouthful. Michael Rubino, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here today.
And I should also add, a former shrimp farmer. Do I have that right?
That's right. Early in my career, I farmed shrimp in those old tidal ponds in South Carolina down in the Lowcountry.
So why don't you do that anymore?
Well, the price of shrimp today is the same as it was 20 years ago. So the real price of shrimp, as you might imagine, has come down dramatically since then with the rise in aquaculture and seafood farming in other countries. It's also cold up here, so it's a little hard to grow shrimp. We're better here at growing more temperate water species.
And let me just give out that phone number, because I'm sure there'll be folks who want to join our conversation. That phone number, again, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about shrimp and fish grown domestically here in the United States. Michael, it does look like, though, there are some signs of a growing domestic shrimp industry. Are you seeing that?
Not so much with shrimp, but with aquaculture more generally. Going back to your top issue of why are we importing so much seafood and why are we sort of underperforming here in the U.S. in terms of aquaculture, as a country, we're a very large consumer of seafood, and my agency has worked very hard to end overfishing and to make sure that our wild stocks are sustainably managed and to conserve the habitat that those wild stocks depend upon. But that wild catch alone is no longer supplying the market. So other countries have been happy to send us their seafood to fill that gap. If you look at a supermarket or if you go to a restaurant, we're buying a lot of shrimp, salmon, and tilapia, all of which is imported, all of which is from aquaculture. What's wrong with that picture? The first thing is doctors and nutritionists are asking us to double our seafood consumption from roughly one meal a week to two meals a week. Where's all that seafood going to come from? So I think, as you've said, we sort of have a choice. We can continue to import even more of that, or we can grow it here in the U.S. Another challenge is one of global demographics. We don't have a seafood supply shortage right now. You and I can go and buy all kinds of seafood at the supermarket. But the buyers of that seafood are becoming concerned that all of that seafood we import from Asia and Latin America is going to stay in Asia and Latin America because of the rising middle class in those countries are buying more seafood. You may have noticed that seafood prices are rising.
Yes.
And then lastly, I think perhaps most importantly, by buying so much imported seafood, we're missing out on eating locally grown seafood, grown under our laws and regulations, grown sustainably in our communities, creating jobs here, especially in coastal towns that complement our commercial fishing and help keep working waterfronts alive.
Can, though, America compete in this global marketplace, whether it has to do with price? I'm assuming technology can help bring some of the price of aquaculture down, but it seems like a pretty unlevel playing field, especially having just talked about Thailand.
For some species that are commodities, it can be. But take farmed salmon, for example. A lot of that is grown in Norway and in Chile and in Canada and then imported in the U.S. And the costs of production in those countries are pretty much what they would be here in the United States. It's relatively technology intensive. It's very efficient production. So we could do that here too, but we have a number of challenges. They're kind of sort of four ways to grow seafood in fish farming. You can grow it in ponds like we grow catfish and trout. But we have limited freshwater supply in this country, and catfish farmers are, in some cases, making more money growing corn these days, in part because of import competitions. We can also grow seafood in tanks. You may have heard about recirculating aquaculture, and some people actually are trying to grow shrimp in warehouses near urban centers.
Wow.
And that's one of the things I think that will be coming for the future. But the cost of growing fish or shrimp in tanks is very high. You know, you have to buy the tanks, build the tanks, you've got water systems, you need energy costs, and so on. So those costs will come down, but they're not there yet. The third area is our coastal environment. Think oysters, clams, and mussels. Think salmon farming and net pens in our coastal environment. We could do more of that in the U.S., but we have a lot of people who live along coastlines. We have crowded coastlines, lots of multiple uses. And we have some people who, don't want to see a fish farm off their vacation home, or we have some fishermen who think that producing other species will compete with what they've got. So it's complicated. Those, I think, are some of the challenges that we face. I think we're working on some solutions, too.
Well, and I want to get to the solutions, but let me put something to you, because I have to say, sometimes I don't know what to do. I'm at my supermarket. I'm at the fish counter. I see things that are wild caught. I see things that are farm raised, and I wrestle with myself about if I buy the wild caught, is it better for me, but is it also depleting the supply of fish in the oceans? If it's farm raised, do they use pesticides? Do they use chemicals? Are there sort of environmental impacts of that? Is there the right thing to do under those circumstances?
Well, I guess, as you might imagine, I get asked this question almost every day.
I'm sure you do, and I'm sorry for making you answer it once again.
It's a good question. I think it's important for us to sort of think about where our food comes from and to sort of take responsibility for our own purchasing decisions and to be connected to the environment, to be connected to our oceans, to think about that. Right. And, here in the United States, in fish farming, in aquaculture, our farmers here are using smart design, driven by increasing costs of feed and energy. They become very efficient. We have informed regulations, and consumers, like you just said, want sustainable products. So all of this is pushing the aquaculture industry towards sustainability. That doesn't mean that there are still problems around the world. And this legacy of environmental concerns about aquaculture from the early days of aquaculture 15, 20 years ago still live with us in our sort of popular thought about it. But we've learned a lot in 20 years about what to do and what not to do, and those lessons learned are being applied here in the U.S.
So in terms of things like pesticides or antibiotics or even fish injected with dye, if we buy domestically, if we buy the United States, are those issues?
Yeah, let me give you an example. If you go up to Maine, where we have a revival of our salmon farming industry, they use all local genetic stock, so it's coordinated with the conservation biology on the wild side. They've had virtually no escapes in 10 years. They haven't used antibiotics in 10 years because all the fish are vaccinated.
Wow.
They have underwater cameras and use efficient feeds, so we don't have the waste issue. There's proper siting, to assimilate the waste. They actually fallow between crops, just like in agriculture, so that the bottom of the seafloor can recover. And they're also experimenting with what's called integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, where fish, mussels, and algae are grown in close proximity so that the mussels and algae take up the fish waste. So from an environmental footprint perspective, they're doing the right thing. And by being there, they're also creating jobs in one of the poorest counties in the U.S. And I think there are lots of examples up and down the East Coast now that we're seeing. Fishermen more and more are not thinking about wild versus farm, but they're thinking about a range of technologies to produce seafood. So one day they may be tending their lobster pots, the next day they're farming mussels, for example.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Michael Rubino, and he's director of the Office of Aquaculture at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Service. And we called him up because we spent the first hour of the show talking about some of the problems, some of the abuses of the shrimp industry in Thailand. And we wanted to focus on what's happening here in the United States. If you have any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Michael, you mentioned oysters a little bit earlier, and I was hearing some stories actually on NPR, and I've been doing some reading as well, and it looks like oysters are back after nearly disappearing. Is that true, and is that a sort of a good news story when we think about eating things like oysters?
Oysters are a very good news story from a whole variety of perspectives. I mean, there's been this boom in oyster production around the country, partly helped by some new technologies, partly, I think, in part driven by sort of trendy. I mean, all of my kids who are in their 20s, they go with their friends to happy hours and eat oysters.
Oysters, right.
it's become a thing to do, and I hope, you know, maybe those early consumption patterns will stick. Oysters are grown in our coastal communities, so they're helping to conserve working waterfronts, which also helps commercial fisheries. Oysters, like clams and mussels, actually are filter feeders, so they don't need to be fed. They actually take nutrients from the water. So they're actually creating habitat and cleaning up water for us as they go as well.
Michael, we have a Facebook comment from Larry, and this has to do with shrimp, but he's saying shrimp are easily contaminated by heavy metals and toxins. The idea that they are, you know, they're sort of filtering this stuff, is that a concern?
Well, there are trace compounds that get into almost everything that we eat. But the doctors and nutritionists, as I said, are asking us to eat more seafood, and I think if you go to a number of the seafood and health websites and experts, they'll tell you to eat fish, whether it's farmed or wild, because of those health benefits. We've heard about the omega-3s. We've heard about lean protein. So the benefits of eating seafood, according to all of my colleagues, far outweigh the risks. And a little plug to my agency.
Sure.
We actually have a website called FishWatch. So you can go to fishwatch.gov and look at sort of how all of our wild-caught fish are managed, how our aquaculture is managed, and there are lots of references to these questions about seafood and health.
Let me get
FishWatch.
FishWatch.gov. Let me get Warren to join our conversation. Hi, Warren. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I teach a landscape and horticulture program in Delaware County. It's a career and tech ed program in a VOTEC. And we have in our greenhouse, we raise fish to supplement plant growth. We started out with hydroponics and kind of mushroomed into aquaculture. And my students are constantly asking about careers and if they can do this for a job. And, you know, we hear rumors about them turning old warehouses and factories into these facilities on a large scale. I'm just curious as to what the career outlook is like for that industry in Philadelphia.
Yeah, or even across the country, Warren, because let me give Michael Rubino a chance to respond to that. Is there a future in aquaculture?
We certainly hope so. I think part of it depends upon us. Do we want to make room for aquaculture in our backyards in this country? Do we want to sort of make our permit process a little bit more efficient? But I think it's really a social choice in terms of, and it's applicable to agriculture as well. Do we want aquaculture to be a part of the fabric of our lives? And if we do, I think then there's lots of opportunities. I mean, this summer I know many of those oyster farmers up and down the East Coast are looking for college students and others to come help them tend their oysters and mussels and clams. During the wintertime and the springtime, when they work on the hatcheries, in other words, growing the baby oysters or the small fish, those jobs require a fair amount of education, a college degree, master's, and some technical knowledge. So these are good paying jobs. So There is a future for this.
I hear you. Warren, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Michael, we're almost out of time here, but I was reading about the Gulf Aquaculture Plan, the idea of putting 20 offshore fish farms in the Gulf of Mexico. I guess these would be submerged cages, part of a fish farm project in federal waters. Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah. In fact, my agency has been the one putting together the regulations for that. As a federal agency, we're responsible for what are called federal waters or offshore waters, you know, from the shoreline to 3 miles of state waters, from 3 miles to 200 miles of federal waters. I mentioned, you know, the innovation and technology, the development that's going on in aquaculture. We talked about growing shrimp in recirculating systems and tanks. Your caller talked about aquaponics. One of the other emerging technologies is to go further offshore, away from some of the conflicting coastal uses. But you know, if you're further offshore, you've got logistical issues of getting out there, you've got a higher energy environment, and so on. But scientists and technology guys are solving some of those technical issues. We're being asked to put together a regulatory program and to work with the other federal agencies on how you would actually permit and regulate that in federal waters. So the Gulf of Mexico would be the first place for us to do that in the United States.
Well, we have to end on that note. Michael Rubino, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hope everyone can go out and eat more fish, clams, and oysters.
There you go. Sounds pretty good to me. Michael Rubino, Director of the Office of Aquaculture at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Service. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Ariel Plotnick, the intern for this summer. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer. Emily Hawes helping us out on phones this week. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.